A few days ago, I was having dinner with my wife, and she brought up one of her favorite movies.
Dear Mr. Vernon, we accept the fact that we had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are.
That's the last scene from The Breakfast Club. Five students, after detention, getting the last word in an essay to their principal. My wife had been thinking about the film since its director, John Hughes, passed away last week. She really identified with those students, their fight for respect and recognition, that attitude of, I will define who I am. In many ways, the loss of John Hughes coming after Michael Jackson's death has given children of the 80s this chance to reflect on our decade. And I feel a new sense of pride gelling in us. Back then, growing up in the 80s, brought a certain indignity, this feeling of, don't you wish you were born 10 or 20 years earlier and were shaped by real cultural richness, rock and roll, war, protest? Our time was deemed unremarkable. Yet, if the 80s were just a throwaway decade, why did the entire world mourn and dust off old albums when Michael Jackson was gone? As a man, far from perfect. As a musician, okay, a product of the 60s, but he was king of our 80s. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then make a change. And Michael had something right there. The 80s were no longer a time to change the world. That was done by the generations before us. So to find an identity, to feel important, we had to look inward. I know that may sound selfish, but it really was an opportunity. Free from pressure to join a movement or start a protest, we could dream big for ourselves and figure out what small part we wanted to play when the next transformative moment arrived. And so I understand why my wife felt that connection to The Breakfast Club. We, the children of the 80s, have always struggled to understand our place in the larger story.
You see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, with the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain, and an athlete,
and a basket case, a princess,
and a criminal.
Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
You are listening to NPR News.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Bob Dylan is finally following Elvis Presley and Nat King Cole. He's made a Christmas album. The Dylan album will include Here Comes Santa Claus and O Little Town of Bethlehem. It's not clear if he'll also sing Snowin' in the Wind or Subterranean Homesick Blue Christmas. Just as people say it's not the heat, it's the humidity, the thing to say about Dylan's voice is that it's not his singing, it's his expression. You're listening to Morning Edition.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. If your idea of must-see TV involves competitors, be they arty designers, foodies, or screaming housewives, you are in luck. My next guest puts those shows on the cable network Bravo.
And she said I was on drugs.
Oh, she said things about Greg. She said things about you.
I heard you were talking about me.
Never mind. She called you a crack whore.
How dare you look at me?
Daniel, please pack your knives and go.
What are his stats? He's 39, he's 5'5".
Oh, jeez.
He's very, very hairy.
Oh, my goodness. It's Scary Garcia.
Everyone knows that the fashion business is ruthless. One day you're in, and the next day you're out.
Project Runway, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, Top Chef, and The Real Housewives, those are just some of Bravo's reality show hits. Andy Cohen greenlights them as Bravo's Senior Vice President of Original Programming and Development. And who watches them? Cohen told me that the Bravo audience is one that fits the network's brand, which he described as food, fashion, beauty, design, and pop culture.
We have the most educated audience in all of cable and the most upscale audience in all of cable, meaning the richest, the people with the most money. And we've also isolated two groups. And one are the group that we call the Will and Gracers, and they are mainly urban women, either single or married, but are cosmopolitan, and best male friends who are often gay. And then the other group are a group that we call the PTA Trendsetters, and they are women all over America who are the trendsetters of the PTA. They're the women who pick up their kids from school wearing the latest shoes and carrying the latest bag, and they're trend watchers.
So it seems like you have two different types of reality shows on Bravo. You've got the people who are talented and competing, right?
Yes, and we have competitive reality and then the kind of what we call docu-series.
And so are these the ones, these are the housewives where you just
these are the housewives, exactly. They're everything from flipping out, which follows Jeff Lewis, who's a OCD gay house flipper who's incredibly entertaining to watch, on and on. Or, yes, our entire franchise of The Housewives, which now spans four cities. I call it sociology, anthropology of the rich.
But also, I would call it a guilty pleasure because
watching them is,
I kind of don't want to admit that I like watching it.
You're not alone.
I don't have any problem admitting I watch Project Runway.
Right. Well, you're not alone. You're not alone. Although, you know, people are flying those Housewives flags higher and higher as it becomes more and more of a phenomenon. I bet there are a ton of NPR listeners, actually, who are obsessed by The Real Housewives.
And won't admit it.
And a ton that probably will admit it because they're dying for someone to talk to about it. The thing that's fun about The Housewives is talking to your friends about it.
Well, and also feeling superior. Quite frankly.
Well, you know, we do something with the editing that's called a Bravo wink. We wink at the audience when someone says, I'm the healthiest person in the world. And then you see them ashing their cigarette. That's a very kind of lame example of the wink. But we're kind of letting the audience in on the fun. But I think that what we're not doing is we're not trying to make fun of these women. We love our housewives.
Kim was irritating the crap out of me. She's yelling at me. She's putting her hands in my face. She's screaming. She's lying. She's denying her lies. You need to chill out.
And the thing about it is, they can't stop themselves. I think that's sometimes where the fun comes in.
There was a recent article in the New York Times that said reality show contestants, a lot of them, not just on your network, but in other ones as well, they undergo a grueling schedule. They
Yes.
are kept exhausted. They work 18-hour days. They're given alcohol in some cases, or at least they have access to alcohol. They're deprived of any outside contact. They can't make phone calls. And all of that with the unstated goal of getting them to melt down and to cause some fireworks that we viewers want to see.
I think that the shows that we produce that fall into the category of people who are put into what someone consider to be extreme situations, these are competition reality shows, and these are shows where it's extremely important that everyone is treated the same, and that everyone has the same opportunity to win each challenge and ultimately the show. And for that reason, we do keep them in something of a bubble. And by the way, does being in that heightened bubble of reality exacerbate emotions and make you more focused on the game and sometimes heighten your reaction to what you're doing? Absolutely.
I mean, but do you ever feel that with these contestants that you are crossing the line sometimes in terms of how you treat them? Not in terms of them having unequal treatment, but just in terms of them not being treated humanely, maybe in some circumstances.
No, I think they are treated humanely. I mean, we have doctors on the set. We listen to their concerns. And they're all very cognizant of what they're getting into. I think even someone from Project Runway who was quoted for that Times article you were referring to, I know her well, and I know that she would go back and do it again in a second. It is an exhausting schedule. I'm not taking away from that, but I think everyone is treated humanely, and it's not how we work. We're interested in finding the next great chef. We're not interested in having the next nervous breakdown.
What about Project Runway? Because
now, what about it?
Let's talk about it. Because
what show? I've never heard of that show.
That's the show that, I mean, aside from Queer Eye, that's what really put Bravo on the map. And now
it did after Queer Eye, yeah.
Now it's on Lifetime. And I'm just wondering if you'll be able to recapture that. I mean,
recapture the magic of that show?
Yeah.
Or,
I mean, it was a cultural phenomenon.
You know, Project Runway was a really special show, and we had a great five seasons with it. We loved that show, and we loved the stories that it brought to Bravo and the creativity, and it was a magic five seasons.
But are you worried at all that with Project Runway going to Lifetime and you're focusing now on Housewives, that the image of Bravo will change a bit, maybe change from talent to trash?
I'm not. You know, we've got so much on Bravo and coming up on Bravo, and I think we have so much more going on than The Real Housewives. And I think The Real Housewives is a great, you know, great addition to the portfolio. I think it brings a lot of viewers under our umbrella. And I think they stay and sample other shows. So I feel great about what we have coming up. And there's much more kind of in the design and art and fashion landscapes to come.
Andy Cohen is Bravo's Senior Vice President of Original Programming and Development. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andy Cohen also has his own program on Bravo. It's a talk show called Watch What Happens, sort of like a gay Dick Cavett show.
Awesome New Republic was named the best band in Miami by the Miami New Times this year. They also recently appeared on an episode of the popular TV series The Hills. Not too bad for a band that gets around record labels by encouraging file sharing.
The first thing we did in 2004 was we got a web address and we put up four or five albums of music for free. And that was how we promoted ourselves and how we got gigs for our first tour.
That was Michael John Hancock from the band Awesome New Republic. To find out more about how entertainers are using technology, go to npr.org/soapbox. There you'll find a link to Queena Kim's podcast, cyberfrequencies.com, which is devoted to stories buzzing on the web. It's all part of Maker's Quest, a project of the Association of Independence in Radio Incorporated and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.